Hi, and welcome to another episode of Stories of Climate Change Hope, the podcast that brings you a little bit of hope every other week. My name is Stefan Schwartmann. Today we listen to the climate story of Carla Madueño Florian. She is part of the Youth in Landscape Steering Committee at the Global Landscapes Forum. She's also a blogger, and as she describes herself, she's a person embarking herself on a journey of discovery and self-determination. She's following her passion in science and nature. She first started following her passion in science in formal education, studying biology, and then she got more fascinated by nature and she dived into more practice-oriented and advocacy work. And we have her here today to talk about our experiences at COP26 in Glasgow this November this year. We will share our insight into the conference. We will share how we felt being at COP. We also share some criticism, and hopefully this will also help you a little bit in case you are wondering how it is to be at COP26 and help you maybe even if you plan to go to one of the upcoming conferences of the parties. So yeah, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Maybe we can talk about the COP26 that we both attended. And I can also mention that we met there for the first time. So you also studied, you graduated in global change ecology, and I'm still a student in global change ecology at the University of Bayreuth. So we both knew we would be there, and
yes.
We met each other there.
That's a GCE world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it your first COP, or have you been to many COPs before?
No, my second only. The first one through GCE as well.
And what would you say was your impression in Glasgow? Maybe even because you have been to another COP, like if you could say, are there major differences?
So I think the point here is it's not my first UN space that I have attended. It would, as a matter of fact, be kind of the fifth to sixth conference at the UN like atmosphere, but it is the second COP that I attend. That means it's the second space of high political negotiators meeting to determine the future of our freaking planet. Bonn, in that matters, was also, I didn't understand the process back then, although we were in a student delegation and there was this continuity of the University of Bayreuth being an observer for many years, there was not really like a handbook on what do you need to do or what activities could you actively engage in while being at the venue as an observer. Like nobody gave us a roadmap, so we were pretty much just told book your train and your stay and manage the 1 week in Bonn and try to attend as many side events in the pavilions, because there is always this green and blue zone. The green zone is for the public, the blue zone is for the delegate only. And in the blue zone, you have the pavilion zone, which is for everybody to come by and share projects and latest launchings of programs and databases or alliances. And then there is the high level space within the blue zone, which is the negotiating space, where you do not have entry if you are not a negotiating party or an accredited observer. And often, I mean, that is a process I didn't know back then in 2017, but often if the room fills up of a certain negotiation on a certain topic, then observers will be the first ones being kicked out because parties have priority, obviously, because it's the conference of the parties. So that's something, for instance, that went completely unnoticed. So I literally joined First COP without knowing about this. And I feel, looking back now, I feel there must have been much more of knowledge transfer in how this observer, I'm not criticizing University of Bayreuth, I'm just perhaps even generalizing, and I'm pretty sure many observers attend COP thinking they will give you the mic and they will let you speak. But that's not how it is. You need to go with a strategy. You need to go even with an entire year of work program, of having linked with other organizations, so that when you are on site, on the venue physically, you meet your partners, your allies, and then you build civil society pressure on items that you have been tracking throughout an entire year. So it's not a work for 1 month, 1 week only. It's the result of one entire year of analysis and kind of an investigation that you want to do, because you really need to know what are the flaws, where are the weak points of each negotiating party. And this is very hard because we're talking about the entire world, all nations sitting, although we know only a few of them have the historical responsibility for the climate crisis. That's one thing. So that's how I look back at my experience at COP. Nevertheless, the first experience, I think it was kind of a tourist. So I took a lot of selfies with people from Peru, like an ex-minister that is very well known. He now works for WWF, Manuel Pulgar Vidal. Like I felt like it was all about meeting people. I even met some friends from summer schools that were also attending COP. So it was just for me a reaffirmation that I am on track. You know, like if you meet people that are from your same circle, it's like a sticker, hey, Carla, you're doing good, or hey, participant, you are aligned. And then this second COP, it was a different setting. For starters, I was invited to speak. That means somebody from a pre-COP event saw value in the experience or in the youth advocacy work I have been doing. And also, as you said, in this vision of the two worlds that are perhaps not compatible, but necessary, the corporate and the civil society world. And then it just changed the rules of the game, because then I was invited to speak, and that already gives a sense of I am actively a part of COP. I'm not the tourist wandering around pavilions. Like, I am literally part of the program. So then that happened in the Green Zone, my first speech. And then the second one was, again, this is a super... super significant difference. This time I was on my own, so I had to really find my way of integrating myself in a youth delegation on site and following up with their activities. And I think that sense of urgency of making the most of my stay during the first week pushed me to actually network more with how youth organizations have established a working agenda throughout the last year in order to make political incidents on site at the venue. And through YANGO, the United Nations Youth Constituency for Climate Change Issues, through them, I had the opportunity of actually being a speaker for the second time at COP. And that already, like, that reaffirmed them that COP is much more than wandering around as an observer. You can have an active role if you partner, if you talk to peers, if you really want to have a political role. You can have a place at the stage, and you can showcase needs that are unseen in the entire negotiations. And for me, that was fundamental, because through my research, like from a master's and in the latest years, my engagement, there are so many points of the Global South being overlooked at, and I really wanted to put them at least verbally in a space where people are listening. So I realized that observers are actually not observers. They can be speakers. They are speakers. And then at the end of the first week, I had the good luck of meeting a veteran observer, meaning a Peruvian observer that has attended at least 10 COPs. And this guy had a lot of experience in what's the actual role of observers. And he shared with me that exactly what I said, how the work is supposed to be. You need to prepare 1 year in advance. You need to know already, like, people, have them on your phone. You need to have reviewed documents together. You need to know where the UNFCCC is uploading all of the drafts by day, by the hour, on these negotiating lines, on the pledges or whatever, so that you can really do best incidents. And if you really partner up or liaise with powerful observers, you may be even given the chance of taking the mic at the main plenary, which is huge. I mean, everybody was looking at these manifold youth activists talking in the main plenary at the Blue Zone. So that's a possibility for observers. And nobody told me that. It's just you need, like, I think the sense of urgency of me also learning the most and not being like the tourist in the first COP, that made me like really ask the right questions and try to sense the right people. And I wish youth could be, in this sense, perhaps less selfish of saying, I'm at COP because I will upload a picture on my Instagram because I'm just amazing and I'm saving the world, because the world doesn't benefit at all from that selfie that you take. Or this also applies to political leaders, but I am not a political leader, so I'm not going to talk about that. But I wish there could be more sense of building legacy throughout COPs, and that every year is not starting from scratch, but rather builds on the experiences of previous youth, of previous observers, of previous incidences, because it feels like every year they reinvent the wheel, like they start from scratch. So why should we take action on the 1.5 degrees? I mean, this was already agreed 6 years ago. I mean, yeah, I think that's where I'm standing right now. And it gives me, it gives with the people that I'm sharing this with us perspective on what our role can be for Egypt, COP27. There are many ways, especially if you are part of Yango, for instance, of getting a badge. Obviously, you can only travel if you have the financial resources. So there is already kind of an injustice issue, because only the ones living probably in the Global North or earning as much as Global North will be able to do this long trip. But yeah, this is another topic. But yeah, the point, what I'm trying to say is, let's try to build some legacy and facilitate these opportunities for youth. Because for me, I speak English and I have been living in Europe, so it was a bit kind of not too new of a context. Now imagine if you are an Ecuadorian or a Peruvian or a whatever indigenous person that barely speaks English, is the first time going abroad, you get lost in the process. You don't even know how to network and transmit the sense of urgency and destruction of your own forests, of your own homes. So it's a very restrictive and unpenetrable space. And that's why many people were saying COP26 was very restrictive and exclusive. But honestly, I believe that's part kind of the flaw of the United Nations bureaucracy system, that it all needs so many formalities that people living outside this Western system or outside the UN system, like we, I don't work for the UN, you don't work for the UN, we don't know how it goes, only the parties know. We will be completely excluded, wandering around the pavilions, barely even, without the capacity of even linking up with potential partners, because we don't even know who these people are. So it's very hard. Sometimes you can feel like you're lost, like a sardine in a can, like full of people. But you can also share, like, tell me, like, how you felt, but full of people, everybody looking high level, and then you talk like, are these people here for the Instagram picture, or they're really here like for the drowning polar bear on the melting polar caps? Like, what's the motivation? You know?
Yeah, you know that the listener cannot see this, but I was nodding all the time, especially with how you described it, your first experience, your first COP that was in Bonn, because it was very similar to me. Although we know we have some classes like the state of the negotiations and so on, but really being there, you don't really know what to expect. Or maybe we have this, you know, preparation meetings, and people from the years before, they shared some insights, but it wasn't so helpful. Like, what can you really do? So I was, like you were saying, you know, I was just running from side event to side event, and it's insane how it can suck you in. Like, every pavilion has like their own daily program, like from morning till evening, and you don't even know like where to go. Like, there's just so much to do. And in between, I also thought, yeah, what am I doing here? I could have watched these things even from home, because it was mostly hybrid. Just very few events that were, you know, really interactive, mm-hmm. at the COP. Yeah, and some of my mates from the study program who went there, that felt a little bit similar. And the communication somehow was also not so great. You know, in the first 2 days of the World Leaders Summit, we wanted to go to the plenary and we didn't know that it's not possible. So we went there and then the security guy said, no, you cannot go in now and you have to have a ticket. Where do we get a ticket? We didn't know this. We went to the info desk and it's a huge venue. So you have to walk again to the info desk. It's like 5 to 10 minutes walk. And then they tell you, you need to go to your constituency and see if you can get a ticket. And then, okay, so where do I go to find my constituency? If you don't know this, if you've never been there, then yeah, of course, then you look up where is the next constituency meeting. And then some of us went there and was lucky enough actually to get a ticket. So some of us were even
not really
able to go to the plenary. That was, I think, on 1st November, so yeah, during the World Leaders Summit. But there were 4 tickets for the whole constituency of Ringo. Yes. So all research international NGOs who were at COP got 4 tickets.
Yeah, for youth in Yango, because Yango is a constituency, also 4 tickets for about 150 youth delegates. So it's wonderful, the sense of inclusion, right?
Yeah. Still, I mean, it was still very exciting and the energy. So it was my first time, so I didn't know how it would be like. But the energy was amazing. Like, I didn't even notice how tired I was until I got on the bus, because we stayed in Edinburgh. When we got on the train, because we stayed in Edinburgh, so we had to commute every day to Glasgow. And
that's a long trip.
Yeah. Whatever. It was definitely a worth experience, but if I would ever go again and somehow don't have the capacity to prepare properly, like you said, then it would make more sense to give that space, to give that badge to someone who really needs all this network and all these contacts, and to have a better impact, or actually just to have the opportunity to make their voice heard. I think for some, this might be more important maybe than for myself.
Yeah, depends also on your personal goals, but I do see the point of this confusion, right? Of processes not being clear. What is a constituency? Why do you need a ticket if you're already at the venue? Why is there so many, like, controls? It felt sometimes, because for the listener, the COP has badges. That means like ID cards that you have to hang on your neck. And these ID cards will show your name, will show your institution affiliation, and they will show a certain color, like a certain right that you have. And I think the highest color was the color pink with the name of party, meaning you belong to the government of a certain country. And you are a negotiator, and that's why as a party you had access to high-level and closed-door discussions. Then I think the second one following would be party overflow, meaning you were coming from an institution like UNICEF, and you are not a negotiator, but you are in the capacities of making clear interventions. Who knows why did you get that? So that was kind of a red badge or something like that, party overflow. And then there was the UN observer badge, which is blue, means you're an observer sent from a United Nations agency. But then again, you're just observer. So the blue badge will give you access to enter these closed door situations, but you won't be able to speak or take the mic or take the floor. Then you had the general observer badge, which was yellow. And probably, I think that's what GCE's got, which allows you to wander around, enter blue zone, but they will be very restrictive on actually getting you in the negotiation space. And there were, like, for press, there was another color. And then, I don't know, for people that were invited over one day, only perhaps high-level people that are just crashing the venue only for one day, they have had, like, a temporary pass. But what I'm trying to say is I felt, because it's a political space, I felt like in a fashion show, because you would be wearing like high level clothes because you don't want to be, you know, I don't know, this is a bit personal, yeah, but I really want to give a good impression of what I'm doing. So I also need to dress up accordingly and then put on my badge. And then I felt like people will not look like in your eyes or as a person. They only will put eyes on the color of your badge. So you would be walking, you know, passing by so many nationalities and people with suitcases and long coats and whatever. And then they will only be focused about which color are you. So it felt,
felt really political. I noticed that as well for myself somehow, that I was looking at the badge. I wanted to know, where are they from? What color is their badge? And some people I saw, they were turning around their badge, you know. I don't know if want you to see their name or don't want you to see their status. So are they a party overflow? Are they observer? Like normal observer, or you an observer?
Yeah.
I don't
know.
Yeah. But that was weird. Yeah.
I heard, because I read the news. Okay, another feeling that of this connection that I had at COP was, I feel like I learned more from COP through the news than actually being on the site. And as a listener, you would wonder, like, why? Were there no screens? Was there no, like, daily bulletin summarizing the points and greatest pledges on site? Believe me, there was one bulletin landing on your mailbox, but at the end of the day, and these huge pledges, huge statements by Sir David Attenborough and other relevant people, they were done by the hour. So you had higher likelihood of knowing what's happening in the room next by through a BBC article on your phone rather than through actually being on freaking Glasgow physically. So the level of no digitalization and no speed and no connection of what's happening. Like, there was not even a COP app that could storm, like, overwhelm you with notifications on the phone of what's happening. Like, there was absolute disconnect of what's going on. And I do understand they didn't want people, you know, crowds. They didn't want people to line up to see, I don't know, Leonardo DiCaprio or whatever. But at the same time, then it's really hard to actually get the juice of the conference, because honestly, you go there also to see these people, right? And you go there for the political impact they're doing, and at least for us youth, and you just miss it. So that was one point. And then you said, as Stefan, that there was the idea of a COP being a hybrid event. I can actually highly disagree, because the COP was meant for, had a platform where you could access live the events being showcased in the public area in the green zone. And then in theory, access live also, if you're an observer, the negotiations happening closed doors in the high level plenaries. And for those, actually, the transmission rate was super low, and there were significant connection issues, so that people trying to make interventions over the internet, they couldn't get their questions on time. So negotiations sometimes happened without considering the active participation of other parties or negotiators on the phone, because there was simply connectivity issues or I don't know what. And this is really critical if we're talking about people that are coming from island states that are experiencing sea level rise or another issue of climate catastrophe like Madagascar, which is like under significant famines now. So I'm wondering, what's the level of inclusion for the parties that are entitled to speak, but the connectivity is not entitling them to actually speak? And then you realize, as an observer, you are there just decorating the room, because not even the parties that are supposed to speak and are already betroffen, affected by climate change, they're having that guarantee. So then you realize, wow, like this really sucks. And also the restrictions on site by the UK government, that if you are coming from a red zone area like Peru, you would need to do quarantine 10 days in advance before COP in a hotel. Now, I want to ask the audience, who can afford, with our Global South salaries, who can afford a 10-day stay at the hotel paying in pounds? Like, honestly, who? People from Malawi will afford that? People from, like, I don't know, another country, like Bangladesh, will afford that? I honestly don't know. Like, at least I hope they, you know. So I'm wondering, like, what was the level of inclusivity? Because honestly, for those purposes, I would have probably said UK, just open doors demand PCR results to be negative, but then let
And wasn't there even a plan to offer vaccination to all people going to COP? I remember even that our study program coordinator told us, if you didn't get your vaccination yet, you might get it through the UN. But I think, I'm not sure. I don't think it really worked.
I'm not informed about that. I only know about the quarantines and the prices.
Yeah.
So, and then at so many other events like IPES. IPES happened early this year in June, completely virtually. I attended it digitally, the 8th plenary. And I wonder if this is also coming from UN, why can't COP be also like that good of hybrid or digital event? I do get the point that when you are in a big hall and you have Saudi Arabia, Brazil, and India advocating for coal exploration, you do want to be present and say, I don't want this, and take the mic. I do understand the political importance of being in presence, because digitally it can just go unnoticed, the sense of urgency. But for the rest of people that cannot manage, the connections need to be fixed for next meeting. Otherwise, it will continue to have drawbacks. It will continue to have significant challenges for all participants. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, if you don't have their participation, that also means that you don't have their agreement, or you don't have their perspective, which would mean, I mean, it's a global effort, and that would just mean part of the solution is missing.
Mm-hmm. Completely right, yeah.
So to continue to share our insights and our impressions of COP26, I would like to talk about the people that really inspired me. To be honest, you know, it weren't the people who were talking at the plenary or who are so famous. Somehow, yeah, they have... it's generalizing, but somehow I find the people in the side events or who are presenting their personal impact or their own project much more genuine and more believable and trustworthy. There was one Ghanaian farmer, Bismarck Kipabiti, who was talking about this Kwapa Cocoa Union and how fair trade has helped him. So on the one hand, it was really his personal story. On the other hand, it was a little bit promotion for the Fair Trade Foundation. But he has really influenced. I mean, he was really, really inspiring. And then I joined one event with lots of mayors and governors in the Nature Positive Pavilion. There was the mayor of Oslo in Norway, who was really positive, and he said that, yeah, you know, you have to stop with the beautiful speeches and get more boring and get into the details and find out how you can spend the public money that you have for procurement as a city, and how you can change tax components. And the mayor of Fomban in Cameroon, she was very inspiring as well, because there were just some things, you know, that you don't expect, like, yeah, we have to reduce deforestation, and we have to get back ownership of the forests. But then also, she also said, you know, we need to nurture like artistic capabilities, artistic abilities in children. So she was saying, yeah, we also have to write and recite more poems in schools to increase the imagination and people's ability to have an impact.
That's beautiful.
I think it's really related. And plant trees for every born child. I really like that as well. So this was Patricia Hamin Ndam Njoya, and the mayor of Oslo is Raymond Johansson. And then there was someone else at one of the panels at the GLF conference, Galina Angarova, from Cultural Survivor. She's the executive director. So they have a holistic rights-based approach, especially representing indigenous rights and indigenous peoples. And yeah, I found it also inspiring because in that panel, there were some business representatives as well. And she said that she doesn't believe in upscaling. Yeah, making the point that solutions come from local people. So not just from indigenous peoples alone, but
for sure, for
the areas that are protected by indigenous peoples and cared for by indigenous peoples, that these areas should be protected and let them take care of it. So for me, it was most inspiring was meeting those people and listening to them. And I guess it would be amazing to invite them for the podcast to find out more about their positions. Yeah, maybe I can contact them as well and invite them.
Of course. And how do they see that their models can be replicated somewhere else? What is the formula of success, right? Like what are the habilitating conditions that need to exist? And then what is like just the formula? How can you replicate that? And that's amazing. And I can really recall the point of arts. I feel like perhaps connecting the dots, like minutes ago, I said, we are sentient beings. And if we cut humanities, if we cut arts, if we cut poetry, if we cut feeling, if we cut music away from our daily lives, we will stop also the capacity of feeling and of transmitting emotions of urgency, perhaps, of shared responsibility, of joy, of being in the nature and surrounded by admiration towards what nature is, animals, landscapes, sacred spaces. So the more we cut off humanities and arts, the less sentient we become, the more indifferent we become, and the more of a circus this entire crisis turns out. We are kind of under anesthesia because every day my Facebook is filled up with more catastrophes. The press here also plays a role because they don't depict the entire picture, actually. But at some point you become like dormant. You become like under anesthesia, like you cannot feel anymore. So arts are fundamental for helping us reconnect with our feeling, with our roots, with our links, bounds to nature, to whatever motivates us in life, and take it from there. And I think it's very important. Like I can only see that it is something that needs more attention.
I had another question because I'm also interested in how, you know, like experiences of people and education influence them. And I don't know if you want to talk about it, how the place you grew up influenced you. Is that something that did influence you, or was it more like during uni life that you really, I don't know, yeah, got more engaged or got more focused? I got a better idea of what you want to do, what you want to change.
That's a question I haven't asked myself, to be honest, because I just take it for granted. Like coming from Peru, you see the pictures, you see the statistics. It's so wealthy in natural capital and natural assets that there seems to be no other obvious way rather than just advocating for that. But yes, let's not take it for granted, because you may as well come from a rich country and simply don't mind what to do with that natural richness. I think it's a level of, like, looking back, perhaps it's one interpretation that I can give. It's not my final one, but looking back in Latin America, in Peru, you have a lot of violence in the media, like not only crimes, but also injustice, environmental injustice cases happen regularly, are shown in the media, in family time. You're taking dinner with your grandma and parents, and you're watching this news of whatever illegal mining happening in the jungle or overfishing by Chinese floats in our Pacific Ocean, or some case of deep lead and mercury pollution in the blood of people in the Andes. And there is this so much sense of just overwhelming stupidity, because we are so rich in resources, but we are so poor in monetary resources. And then you don't understand why is this not matching, because you know other countries are so rich in monetary resources, but they are not in natural resources. So this is the permanent dilemma of more complex topics of geopolitics and neocolonialism and corruption. But I think that all just triggered in me the question, first of all, the fascination for nature playing in my neighborhood, but also these daily encounters with what my country is made of and who are these people and what's going on, and all of this beauty at threat put in me like the compass of, you need to do something about this. And you know there is a way, because like in summer or whenever we had the financial possibilities, we would travel to the inner parts of the country and we would visit places that are not too developed in infrastructural manner, but that are nevertheless astonishing. And even by very humble people, there are some initiatives of conservation or cultural expression of our Quechua speaking or Amazonian identities. And I think all of that richness, and also stories from the family. So I think that creates a bond to the earth, or sense of belonging. I would say sense of belonging. And with a sense of belonging, many things come along. In my case, it developed, my curiosity into science developed it into later a sense for prioritizing conservation and protecting it. But for other people, it may develop into, I want social justice for people, and I want to engage into educating people, into making education more accessible. Like, why a Quechua speaking person needs to speak Quechua needs to speak Spanish and forget Quechua. Like, and this is happening in 2021. Like, are we still in colonial times or what? So I think one way of solving issues of my country is through conservation and environmentalism. But there are so many ways, because these are all intersectional issues. One thing leads to another. And I think that's kind of how I was shaped, how I see the world, and how I grew up pretty much in a very, very easy manner. I was living in the city Lima, but nevertheless, I had this connection of what's happening right in my country, outside my house or my city.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome.
At the end, I always have a selection of similar questions that I always ask, and especially important. I mean, we have talked about this already, touched upon this already, but what would you say, like, what is it that really keeps you going? What is it that gives you hope, like in terms of staying engaged and in terms of the climate crisis?
So this is a very personal question. What I can share is that I had some deep binding experiences with the Amazonian forest, personal experiences, and then I kind of connected with the immensity, humongous character of perpetual beauty of this forest, of this biome. Its deepest admiration for a sacred place, I cannot describe into words, I'm trying to describe, but it was just an ecosystem type, let's call it in a technical manner, that allowed me to feel a living being much greater than me. And I think ever since then, I have been able to discover this sacred entity in many other landscapes, in the Peruvian Andes when I did my master's thesis. These are spaces of also of my cultural legacy, of people in the past that perhaps were persecuted for being indigenous and all of the colonial process that persecuted our culture and our way, our worldviews. And I feel like these people may be gone, but the magic and the superiority of this understanding of friendship with nature remained, and you can clearly see because it's very still up to date, very well protected, and people now depend on that. So I feel, at least from my country, the landscapes in my country gave me the opportunity to explore this mystical, or to feel this mystical connection with nature. And I think that is what gives me hope, because I have seen it. I have seen how well nature, Mother Earth, Pachamama, whatever name you want to put it, can give to its sons and daughters. And I know this sounds super cheesy, but it feels like that, because it really, it's a blessing. And then the least you can do is try to not destroy it perpetually, because I'm fine if you destroy it temporarily and then you repair. But the stats show us we are taking things to freaking extinction. So this is not like it's going to be gone for 5 years and come back. This is going to be permanently deleted from Earth. And this is something that I cannot remain seated and relaxed, and rather I need to say, do something about it. I don't know if I will manage to do a contribution, but I am trying, hopeful that it will resonate at least, and that it also gives me a sense of belonging and reaffirmation. It's a journey. I cannot say I reached there, but it's a journey, and I can only feel more empowered or inspired by people that are really leaving good salaries behind, leaving reputation behind. They go back to those places and they create amazing conservation initiatives, and then they get the good hearted people. They get donations, they get attention, they get recognitions from the government. So I believe doing the things right is possible, and we can do it. And I think that's where I can leave, kind of finish my reflection. Like that's how I see hope nowadays.